pals o' mine. Happy National Library Week. I began my love of mysteries in high school and would ride my bike to the library to check them out. The library is where I learned to perform real research. There are people today who don't understand why we still need libraries, since so much information is online and you can download books onto reading devices. First of all, not all information is on the internet, and you could not find a better search engine than a librarian who has access to much higher research resources than the internet offers, especially to the general public. Second, unlike a bookstore, the exact book you borrow from the library can also be read by hundreds of additional patrons, thus saving on valuable resources such as, say, trees. Libraries also offer free internet access and community events, such as storytelling for children and classes for literacy and computer classes. This from Neil Gaiman. It's still National Library Week. You should be especially nice to a librarian today or tomorrow, sometime this week anyway. Probably the librarians would like tea or chocolates or a reliable source of funding. As you know, I'm an old movie fan, so I think it's really cool that there is a James Stewart blogathon this week. 30 movie bloggers writing about his films and personal life. Mr. Stewart wrote poems as well, and on YouTube, you can still watch his famous appearance on Johnny Carson when he read his poem about his dog. Check out the James Stewart blogathon on classicfilmtvcafe.com. Have you considered entering the game developer arena? I spoke with Gabriel Gutierrez of Nascent Games, who is currently developing two games for Nintendo. They recently hosted the one-year anniversary of the local chapter of IGDA, showcasing 20 local indie developers. Over 200 people attended this first annual event.
My earliest memory after Pong and Froggy was Larry the Lounge Lizard.
Nice.
Yes. Okay. I thought that was hysterical, that the point of the game was to get him laid. I thought that was funnier than hell.
To this day, it's still hilarious.
It yeah. is. It yeah. cracks me
it
up.
It really is, as a matter of fact.
Are there any games that have been around that long that are still popular, that continue to...
Funny enough, that particular game, and it's actually Leisure Suit Larry.
Oh, Leisure. Leisure Suit Larry.
They're actually bringing him back, the original creator. They got into an agreement to actually bring the character back.
And, like, really?
The whole new... The original voice actor and everything. And that's a spectacular thing to see, because I was... When I first played it, I was in my early teens, and I'm playing it on this computer, and so funny, my ex-stepdad, he tells me about this game, and he was obsessed with computer games like I was, and shows me this game, and I'm like, what in the world is this? Why is this so perverted? It's showing so much, and I'm like 14, so such an impressionable age. But so they're bringing that game back, and love that game. I think Pac-Man is legendary. They just brought out another version of Pac-Man just recently.
Seriously?
Yeah, they did. And in the arcades, Dave and Buster's is a perfect example. Dave and Buster's has now a four-player champion edition Pac-Man. Four people fighting each other at once.
That is so funny.
It's hilarious. And it's weird, though, because...
I'll say.
Yeah, it's weird because those were it. Those were the games that started everything. And, first time I played Pac-Man, I was five. It was on black and white television on the Atari 2600. My cousins next door had it. I was like, what in the world is this? My heart just skipped a million beats. So, yeah, So between those games, the Super Mario Brothers games, those are forever legendary. A lot of Nintendo games, as a matter of fact, you would think the Atari games, but the Atari games set the foundation. But I think the Nintendo games are the ones that are going to, are continuing to blaze in innovation and progression to this day. It's quite surreal to see that, you know, what I grew up with as a little kid that made me get into game development in the first place. And now I see these games today, and now the young kids are like, what is this game? And I'm like, oh, if you only knew. So it's
You're the sage.
Yeah.
The sage player.
Pretty much, yeah.
Well, where else can you take Pac-Man except adding more players? I mean, it's just chasing dots. It isn't like you can have plots or scenes right. or anything.
Well, truth be told, there is actually one game in particular called The Ghostly Adventures.
Oh, of course.
Just
right.
yes, yeah, so that's it's a right. it's a 3D exploration game, 3D exploration adventure game, and yep, it's you against the ghost, and
okay.
you have your help, and you know Pac-Man Jr. and little Miss, you know, Miss Pac-Man helping out too. So it's a, you know, it's pretty nuts, you know, what you can add to it. I'm surprised they haven't added a Pac-Man fighting game yet. So you're just literally just fighting each other. I don't
know.
So
they don't need limbs like Monty Python?
No, but someone will make it, though, I'm pretty sure, all they got to do. So that's all you need now at this stage of the game. But yeah, it's pretty impressive. You know, let's face it, look at what they've done with Lego. I mean, Lego has been around since the dawn of time, I think, it feels like. And now there's so many video games and now a movie about it, which was spectacular. And it's crazy what people have done, you know, us growing up now and bringing our imaginations to life now. It's really astounding to see what's happened here.
So you say Nintendo has more of the indie game publishers? Is that what you would call them? Publishers or creators? Or?
Yeah, I would say it's an interesting call with who actually has more indie developers, yeah, because it's not really publishers per se.
Yeah, I wasn't
se.
Sure what the word was.
Yeah, no.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. Yeah, it's funny because the whole thing of indie is no publishing. They don't want to rely on a publisher. They are themselves. They're supposed to be their own entity, their own presence. And I think it's funny because Microsoft actually started that with their Xbox 360. They created a platform called Xbox Live Indie Games, and it was that which would really start it at all. It was essentially saying, hey, make your own game. You don't need a publisher. Pay the small amount of money to get a license to release on us, and that's it. They dropped the ball very quickly, though, on the care they should have given to the indie developers, because it was an explosion. It was just literally an explosion of indie developers. It was great to see what was happening. A lot of the games were crap, but I mean, it was great to see that, like, someone who, you know, you paid $100, you know, you paid $100 to get the license and the software, and there you are making your own stuff, and now it's on an Xbox platform, you know, but you have to advertise it yourself. And I think that's where things were still kind of coming into fruition, coming into its maturity. Like, how do we get this game out there? Oh my God, I'm on Microsoft Xbox. But Nintendo followed through very quickly after that on their Wii system, did really poorly in how they took care of the indie developers there too. It was Sony with their PlayStation platform. I think that's where they got it right. They messed up at first too, but they were the quickest to fix what they did wrong, because they saw what the other two weren't doing, and then they started looking at what was happening on the PC, on the computer, and then with Android and Apple development as well, iOS, and Sony was like, okay, we can't do this. We got to treat these people better. So I would say between Sony and Nintendo right now, I think they've got the most. Microsoft, they're still getting a bad rap. They've improved things, but they're still getting a bad rap right now.
So it's really the number of platforms that are available. That seems to be the ongoing issue.
There's so many platforms now, and that's what's happened in just these past probably 5-6 years where back then you maybe had a couple platforms on top, you know, tops. But now it's, you know, even on the PC alone, you have Steam, you have a website called Desura. Even GameStop created their own, I think they bought someone out and created their own website called Congregate. And now you can release your games on there. And it's just crazy the amount of options one developer has to just put their games on, and on top of the consoles out there. So it's pretty crazy to...
So it is similar to publishers' books, insofar as a publisher may take on your book, but you still have to market it yourself, and a lot of authors don't realize that. And
pretty much,
yeah.
It's
a rude surprise when
they find that. And in this particular case, and this is where there's been a lot of fine lines with each of these platforms, has been the fact that Sony has a set of rules, and they're very flexible, whereas Microsoft, they have some very strict rules still, and people are like, well, what's the point? Like, well, what's the point of being indie if we don't have that kind of flexibility? Yeah, and it's essentially now they're not publishing it per se, they're giving you the platform. They're saying, okay, we'll take our cut because you're using our platform to release your games on. It's a bit more fair than what the publishers would ask for. But yeah, like you've said, how similar it really is to self-publishing your own book or hunting for an agent or and a publisher. And yeah.
Well, I'm curious, insofar as marketing is concerned, because a lot of musicians now have in-house concerts, you know, mm-hmm. sell their CDs mm-hmm. and music, mm-hmm. and authors are slow to get onto that train. I'm wondering if indie web developers are doing that too. You could give examples, let people play with it in the living rooms.
The perfect example, and it's funny enough with the with different rock bands and stuff like that they have to sell CDs and their own paraphernalia, you know, their own t-shirts and all this other stuff to even make something. It's kind of the same thing here with indie developers. I, for example, with Nascent Games, you know, the one I think that it's been a very popular thing is you're making a game, and whatever game you're making, you kind of spread the word about it. But you make if the music you make for it, if you have some good music, good chunk of music, create a soundtrack, you know, your own little soundtrack, sell it on a website like Bandcamp or something. That's what I did. I decided to take music from the couple of games I'm working on and just did a little compilation soundtrack. It's kind of a little bit of attention, which is nice.
You diversifying know, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, definitely. So it gives people an audio teaser of what's coming soon. Sell it for super cheap because it's digital. So, you know, 9 tracks, $3.
Oh, good.
You know, sell it out that way and just kind of take it from there. So it's pretty good. But it's just one option. Some other people, what they do, there's one particular developer. He was actually building what they call alpha versions of his game. And what he would do is he would say, I'm constantly updating this and that, this and that. This is what I'm selling the alpha for. And now typically you wouldn't ever pay for an alpha because it's essentially an incomplete game. But the scale of the alpha would be so big that people would be like, okay, if you have a lot going on, I'll give you $3. I'll give you $5 or whatever the case may be. The ultimate goal was once the full version comes out, you don't have to pay anything. Some people did it right. A couple of people didn't do it very right, and still keeping it as alpha or a beta, and people are like, well, what the hell are you doing? So it's like, once it's done. So there are a lot of options out there with trying to make that extra dollar or two, but it's all implementation and how passionate you are. You know, not just how passionate you are about getting the game out there, but how do you implement it? That's crazy.
And also you have, well, there's certain genres,
mm-hmm,
I'm guessing, that are more popular than others. What's the current?
Honestly, it was the first-person shooter, but now it's the puzzle platformers. It's those artsy games, you know, with that art, you know, that artsy look to it, the stylized look, that or that abstract vibe. But it's always those puzzle platformers that just draw people in. They want that challenge. You know, they want to get frustrated when they try to figure this out and pulling their hair out, and then they finally solve it, like, yeah, you know, massive satisfying feeling. And I do think it's those games. I think second to that are the storytelling games, because people, there are those out there like me, I'm a story person. The games I'm making, they're going to have a core to it, but it's going to have this story where people can actually be really involved with it. That's, you create that sense of escapism, if you will. But yeah, I think other than puzzle platformers, it's the story narrative type of games.
When you talk about stories, does that include the plots? And I know some of them, the plots, the plot not only thickens, but it boils over and you don't know what the hell is going on.
Right. But it's funny you say that, though, because one of the things are a lot of these game developers who pen their own story. I'm penning the story for the couple games I'm doing right now. It's not always done effectively. It's not always, they try to pull like what the Sopranos did at the very last episode with the sudden cut to black. And people are like, what in the world just happened? And then there's never an explanation. So you have some games like... But then there's those other games. A great example is a game called Journey. That was a game was literally poetry in motion. The game was literally told through your actions as you went forward. There was no talking. There was no sort of text. So everything was visual, was literal, and in some cases very metaphorical.
Hmm.
but it wasn't complex, metaphorical. It was, you got it. You understood where they were going with the light at the top of the mountain. Okay, why? But then when you get there, there was a whole other message to it when you got there. And you got it. It was astounding stuff. And it's funny because it's falling apart in movies. So, like, people don't know how to tell stories in these movies anymore, other than, like, a good Sundance film or something like that. But I think it's kind of moved towards video games. And it's so funny how that circle just kind of goes around from crappy movies to good video games. So now Hollywood are trying to rely on the success of these video games
for ideas.
For ideas now. Which, I mean, look at what they've done with comic books already. My goodness, Marvel.
They're killing Archie off. What the hell? First Captain America, and now Archie. I don't understand why they needed to do that. Can't they just live on in perpetuity? Why do they have their life have to end?
I absolutely agree. It's like the whole point, as I mentioned, escapism. We come to this, we escape from what's going on around us, really, and go to rely on that. And yeah, I just, it's mind blowing.
I was not happy to hear that.
No, I bet.
But, you know, speaking of frustration in games, and, you know, you hear in the news periodically, you know, how violent video games are. And I have to laugh because you hear the same thing about hard rock and metal. And people are not going to go on a violent rampage unless they're already pissed off.
Right.
You know what I mean? But what I saw, I can't remember where I read it. I think it was Bloomberg News Review, where this man made a great point. He said, people don't get angry and violent from playing the game. They get angry and violent when they aren't winning.
Right. <You know? laughs> that is absolutely true.
How accurate is that?
It's true. It is absolutely true. I get super frustrated. We were talking about puzzle games. Tetris.
Example the author used. Tetris. How pissed off people get at Tetris.
I'm living proof. And I mean, and I know so many people who are like, oh my God, I can't believe I missed that line. And that's just it. The game is essentially about forming lines. I mean, squares. And they're literally pissing us off, boiling our blood. It's the same thing with movies. What they say about violent movies is like, come on, stop it, people. Seriously.
You know? I do think it's a valid point if they're little kids, because little kids are still learning right from wrong.
Right.
And if the parents or guardians, whoever, aren't pointing out, like, this is not real.
Right.
You know, this is game. We actually have to treat people like this.
Right.
Then you could cause problems as they get older. So.
I was very fortunate because my father, it's interesting to say that because my dad and I, when I was growing up, I grew up watching wrestling, you know, the World Wrestling Federation, and, you know, and then watching movies like Rambo and Commando, anything that had Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone, Steven Seagal, my dad was all over it. Clint Eastwood, those were my father's favorite types of movies. All involved guns, all involved violence, and I would be watching this with my dad. I'm like, what in the world is happening? And here I am, 4 or 5 years old, and talking to my dad, and I can't believe, and I'm freaking out. Like, Dad, why is this happening? Said, this is fake. But it looks so real. It's like, I don't understand. How is this fake? And he explained it to me. I'm 5. I don't think that's happening today. Like, I think there's such a fear from parents to even show them at all what it is, that it's like they get closeted, and then, you know, these little kids or even preteens start learning from other sources, poorer sources, and where they didn't get the guidance they needed either. And now they're learning kind of like third party. It's kind of like when you're trying to buy insurance or something like that directly, but you get it from a third party, and now you've paid a bigger price. Simple, crazy analogy, but that's what it is.
So do you think the covers of video games that have the warning on here, violence, obviously a teenager or somebody's going to ignore that and get it anyway, but do you think it's more of a guideline for parents so they know which ones not to buy the little ones?
Yeah.
Or do you think anybody's even looking at them?
No, I think they're looking at it. I just don't think they care. I mean, in some cases they do. Some places like GameStop, they'll card the kid. If the kid's really young, you're looking like, how old are you? You know,
nice.
They want to buy, they'll card them. I think that's great. I just don't think it's being enforced anywhere else other than GameStop.
Well, it's a start, I guess.
You had to start somewhere, indeed. And it's weird. The rating system, which was formed in the early 90s, only happened because of Mortal Kombat, this game Mortal Kombat. Because prior to Mortal Kombat, there were no ratings. There were no rating systems at all. So you had all these people trying to play, like, Mortal Kombat, humans facing, you know, beating the hell out of each other. But it was the first violent, ultra-violent game, the way they you would finish a person off. And there was such an outcry from parents. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And, you know, then they formed this, what they call the ESRB. So it's this ratings board, but it's a joke now. It's like, for what? What's the point? The kid's going to, you talk about the, you know, kid getting carded. If he can't buy it because mommy said no, or the mom's not there, the kid's going to play it at his friend's house. Yeah, it's a tough, tough thing today because there's so many ways to watch it. YouTube alone, you could watch it. And you don't even need to play the game. You can watch an entire game from start to finish on YouTube just because someone videotaped the entire thing. And there you go. You didn't even have to buy the game now.
Unless somebody takes it down.
yeah, good luck. You take one, seven
download it now.
Yeah,
quick.
Yeah. Download now before I get caught. So.
What's been the craziest video game that you've seen that was really out of left field that you didn't see coming?
Oh, wow. Jeez, that's a great one.
Any realm, any genre?
I think one in particular that really blew me away, there was a game called Limbo. It was an indie game. It was an indie developed game. Came out back in, I think, 2009 or something like that. It was essentially about a 10-year-old boy who wakes up in Limbo. For those who know what Limbo is, the entrance to the first circle of hell. And it's like, what in the world is a kid doing in hell? He's dead. What did he do? The game was essentially a puzzle platforming type of game. Very minimalistic. It was essentially a silhouetted game. You didn't actually see the detail of the kid's figure. You only saw a shape, like an outline of the body, but that was it. If anything had ever actually happened to him, like say he would go through these puzzles and traps or whatever, there were some violent parts, you know, and you had the option to turn it off, you know, so nothing would happen to him per se. For example, there was one part where you're at a tree and, you know, and you see what's like ball to this, I guess, a stick. So you pull the stick out and it turns out it's the head of a spider. What? And it's crazy. And, you know, and it's nuts because, again, like I said, they're all just black outlines. They're just silhouettes. So you don't actually see the detail. And that's what adds to the creep factor of it, because it's like, until it started actually moving, then it was like, oh my God, it's a huge spider. And if you don't move, it will actually jam one of its legs through you and you're done. And it's crazy because you'll see, you know, splatter, but it's flat. So like the imagination is...
fills in the just, color.
Yeah, hugely, hugely. And
so it's psychologically very dark.
Yes, yes, psychologically very, very, very dark. And I personally like games like that. But, but when I like those minds screwing around like that. But I'm
too bad Hitchcock's not around.
I know, he would have been so proud, seriously, because it looked like that, you know, just those silhouette figures and stuff. But it was definitely psychological. Yeah, that game really tripped me out because it's like, wow, 10-year-old boy. But there was not one complaint about that game, and it was a 10-year-old boy, which was the craziest part.
Well, it could be because you said there wasn't a face,
right?
So you couldn't
could be
as
yeah.
disturbing as it would have been if there mm-hmm. had been a face.
Quite true.
So maybe that's how they kind of skirted the...
It's actually a very good point, yeah, because it was just, you see he's a little kid, but you don't see anything else. You don't see any other details. And even actually the eyes, it's just the whites of the kid's eyes. The amount of games in Nintendo right now, I think it's... I'm probably off about this. I think they're probably around 75 to 100 right now on their newest console, the Wii U. And I'm aiming to be two of those games. So part of that team's... Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
So how many people are in your team?
Right now, we have actively about 6-7 people helping out, in addition to a few college interns from one of the local art schools, Art Institute. I have a couple of people from there helping out, so, which is great.
And so two games Nintendo has taken of yours?
Yes. Yeah. And hopefully, if it works out, we'll do a third one and take it from that. Yep.
So what are the genres?
So the two that we're actively working on now, there's a small-scale game, it's a puzzle platformer, very heavily animated type of game. Then the second game is an action sci-fi space shooter, much bigger scale game. That game is going to have a big focus on narrative, and I have big plans to take that story in that universe beyond that first game. Like, I already have part 2 and 3. In the early planning stages.
So how do you even begin to approach an organization like Nintendo with the game? Do you give them a slice drawing board of sorts, a sketch board, or what do you...
Well, the way they did it with this, and this is what made it very rare of an opportunity, was Nintendo put out a call because... Well, let me actually kind of take it back a little bit. I mentioned earlier about their Wii platform and how they were bringing... They provided the opportunity for indie developers to make their own games too. The problem back then was that it was a super, super restricted restrictive, and to the point of the one big rule in particular was, okay, so if you're an indie developer, we all know what indie means. You're on a super, super tight budget. You know, you all kind of have your own funding, you know, your own money, whatever. But one of their big rules was you have to have an office. You have to have an actual office. Your indie studio can't be run from home. Otherwise, it doesn't count. A lot of people were unhappy with that. Like, well, wait, we don't even have a game out. What's the purpose of being indie if we have to buy a studio to do something? A lot of people went into debt trying to do that just to get on there, because the install base of the Wii, the amount of people that owned a Wii system was huge. I mean, tens of millions. But no one cared for it. No one cared for the indie platform because the casual gamer didn't. They just wanted to play Wii bowling. They didn't care about else. So it was a very, very tough thing to go through. With the Wii U coming that came out, they completely revamped everything. They're like, no, you can be home base now, blah blah blah. So they put out this call to indie developers. It really, in a way, to say, we screwed up, we're sorry for having that ignorant mentality back then. We're opening it up to all indie developers. All you have to do, tell us about your games, when you plan on having them out, and we'll talk. And that's what I did. About 4 months after, it took about 3-4 months, because a lot of people responded, so obviously. Yeah, 3-4 months, about 3.5 months later, I got an email from Nintendo saying, I talked to someone in person, that was like, holy crap, this is fantastic. And then they provided me with all the tools to make the games.
To get her done.
To get it done, yes.
So how do you even begin to create a game? Or develop a game, I should say.
It's funny, in this particular case, you have to have almost an artist's eye. You have to look at the obvious and then make it not so obvious. You know, how would you twist it? How would you do this? How would you make it better? How would you bring it to life?
Is there general software, basic software you can...
There's a ton of them. There's a ton of different software engines, game engines and such. One in particular that Nintendo provides is called Unity. Very, very popular graphic program. Very expensive, but that might be changing very soon anyway, but that's a whole other story. So what happens is you have these options to make this and that. And yeah, so there's a lot of software options out there for making a game. I mean, even some out there where you don't even need to be a programmer. It's very simple to do this and that. I'm one of those guys who I can't program or draw, but there's a ton of software out there. You know, Game Maker is a very popular one. A lot of successful games have been made on Game Maker where you don't even need to hire a programmer. And you've had one-man shows creating all these games, you know, creating this a game or two all on their own. They've actually done very, very well for themselves. So yeah, it's very interesting to see.
How did you get your crew together?
Funny enough, I had a programmer back in the East Coast because I'm from New Jersey. So I had a programmer from back home. He was going to help me. Then he got a girlfriend. Then he couldn't help me.
Damn love.
There's
always a woman in the background screwing things up.
It's funny, yeah.
He was your Yoko Ono.
He really was, God forbid. I got so fed up and I was like, okay, I got to do something because I just moved here to California. I didn't know anybody, so I was here maybe 3 months when this happened. What am I going to do? So I started thinking the one place that I could possibly have something was an anime convention. Find an artist.
There we go.
So I ended up doing some research and I discovered SAC Anime. Went, funny enough, and it had to be fate, I guess, if you believe in that sort of thing. It's the SAC Anime was 4 days later. Oh my goodness. So I did my research at what they had going on over there, and I saw that they were having an amateur voice acting panel. So I'm like, I'm going to go that Saturday, and I'm going to kill two birds with one stone. I'm going to see if I can look for a voice actor. Maybe if I find an artist in the artist alley. We'll see. So yeah, went there and I actually connected with the first four people on my team. Only one or two of them are actually still helping me now, but those first four started a big networking thing with, you know, who they knew and so on and so forth. They're like, oh, I know this person who can do this and so on and so forth. And then they started learning about what I do and what I want trying to do. So yeah, it became just this massive snowball effect. It was.
So how do you know about voice? Do you know that voice when you hear it, or do you already have an idea?
You have an idea, but it's funny because you want to have your expectations in a certain level, but at the same time, you have to be open enough to hearing something you weren't ready to hear. And that's happened to me a few times already, where, yeah, for example, one of my voice actresses, you know, I met her, talked, and she sang. We went somewhere, we talked for a little bit. I said, because she talked about she sang, I was like, okay, can you sing a little something, hum a little tune or whatever? And she did her thing, and I was just mesmerized. I was like, oh my goodness. So get her over the house, and we start doing a little recording stuff. Took a break, and then, well, I walked away to get her a drink or whatever. In my studio, there's a keyboard, and I start hearing music come out of my keyboard, and I'm like, wow, that sounds really pretty, and it didn't even register with me, like, well, wait, who's this? Who's playing my thing? Turned out to be her. Really, afterwards, it was when she was playing the piano, she started humming in a different accent.
How do you hum in an accent?
Weird, because she was, like, talking, but not using words, per se, but it was still coming out in this tone. She was, like, practicing this tone with her throat. It was the strangest thing to see, but it worked. And that's when I'm like, wait, what else can you do? And she ended up speaking a Russian accent, a Ukraine accent, an English one, an Australian one. I was like, oh my God. And those
ka-ching,
are,
ka-ching.
Yeah, pretty much where I was like, you are going to be awesome. And I want you with me as long as possible. So
forever,
yeah.
And ever.
Yeah. So fortunately, she's still with me today. She's in South Korea right now, but she is good. She is very, very good. And I cannot wait for her to come back home so we can keep going forward with everything.
So where do you see games? Where do they seem to be headed now?
Well, at this stage of the game, it's good. It's interesting with... It seems two extremes are happening now, because you have the indie game development side that has been blowing up its spot and is continuing to do strong. But now you have the virtual reality side, which is where Facebook, for example, just bought Oculus Rift. This is a virtual reality headset. And people wondered, why in the world would Facebook even care about something like that? I still feel that way because I just don't trust Facebook, period. I haven't trusted Facebook at all for a long time. But they buy this huge virtual reality startup. Plus, with Sony announcing their virtual reality headset, big thing now. So, and it's funny because virtual reality isn't exactly new. It came out, first introduced back in the early mid-90s, but it was just way ahead of its time. Now, is it finally coming together and, you know, where they can show a very graphical quality type of presentation, as well as a quality built and not so expensive type of option. I think that's really impressive, and that's going to be a big, big thing for the next probably couple of years, I would think, at least for now.
Do you think that Google Glasses has something to do with that? Getting more mainstream, I mean?
Maybe. I think...
Just the idea that kind of, that the so-called average person can actually put them on and see what it's like, and they're not just reading about it or
watching
a video about it.
It may have something to do with it, but I think, in fact, actually, Google Glass, it's funny you say that, because they went on sale today just for one day only, and they also did a big update on their software, which I find funny. My glasses got a software update, which is just strange. That's essentially what happened here. But they removed the thing for video calls, where you used to be able to do video calls on Google Glass. Now they removed the option. So why they did that, I don't know. But yeah, it's a weird thing now. Maybe it has something to do with the whole Facebook buying Oculus Rift thing on that end. I don't know. But I found that to be a very odd thing.
Well, I know there were complaints about that option, because you're not paying attention if you're walking or driving. So I kind of get where that came from.
Yeah,
potential liability and all that.
Right, yeah, that is true.
Yeah, pocketbooks always talk.
Yes, they do. Yes, they really do.
You can follow Nascent at Nascent Games. That's NASCENT Games.com. And lest you assume gamers are self-absorbed, you should know about Child's Play. Based out of Redmond, Washington, this is a game industry charity dedicated to improving the lives of children with toys and games in a network of over 70 hospitals worldwide. To donate funds or items, visit childsplaycharity.org. For this week's National Park Highlight, in my ongoing celebration of this year's 150th anniversary of the National Park System, I'm heading over to Cornish, New Hampshire, site of the home, studios, and gardens of sculptor Augustus St. Gaudens. Although he was considered American, he was actually born in Dublin, Ireland, and his family moved to the U.S. when he was 6 months old. In 1965, his home and studios became the first site in the National Park Service to commemorate a visual artist, and the 250-plus acres is the only national park site in the state. Over 100 pieces of his work are on display in the galleries and on the grounds. In his teenage years, he had been a cameo cutter apprentice in New York City, and from his window he witnessed many events, including Abraham Lincoln traveling to Washington for his first inauguration. and he was also good friends with John Hay, Lincoln's personal secretary. The 12-foot-tall standing Lincoln was his first statue of Lincoln. Lincoln's son Robert considered this the best sculpture of his father. Reproductions can be found around the country in London and Mexico City. The 1909 image of Lincoln used for the 1909 commemorative stamp was drawn from the head of the statue. It was created in a studio converted from an old hay barn in Cornish. He constructed a two-story barn-like structure called the Large Studio. It tapered to one story tall at one end, much like an old camera bellows, so that he could look at the sculpture from a distance. His other famous Lincoln is the Seated Lincoln in Grand Park, Chicago. It was also created in Cornish. Other public monuments of his include the General William T. Sherman Monument in New York, the Shaw Memorial in Boston, and a 65-foot-tall pyramid with 2 9-foot-high relief portraits in Laramie, Wyoming. Not only did General Sherman sit for his portrait with Saint-Gaudens, but so did Robert Louis Stevenson. Imagine dinner stories he could have shared. At the request of Theodore Roosevelt, he designed the 1907 $20 gold piece, the first sculptor ever to do this. A World War II Liberty ship was named after him and launched in March of 1944 in Panama City, Florida, and was later used to ferry troops during D-Day, June 6th. There are a couple of short nature trails on the site to visit in addition to tours of the home and studio. In fact, there are apps available for self-guided tours. Interestingly, well, to me, Augustus married an Augusta. Gus 1, Gus 2? By the way, the National Park Foundation is promoting a sweepstakes for a 7-day adventure in Alaska. Visit nationalparks.org/NPW/2014sweepstakes. Earth Day is next week. There are so many creative ideas out there for you to cycle all sorts of items. If you can't find anything particularly useful, give it away for free on Craigslist. Someone else might be able to repurpose it. And don't forget the ultimate recycle. Yourself and biodegradable urns. Do something different. Wrap a present in comic strips.